Chapter 8. Have asked him 2 or 3 weeks ago. Now, of all social things, that Pearson liked it was to be asked to dinner offhand, as a stopgap in place of some bishop, earl, or undersecretary who couldn't come, and when the invitation was supplemented by the tidings that the lady who had so impressed him was to be one of the guests, he had promised instantly. At the dinner, he took down Mrs. Pinavon upon his arm, and talked to nobody else during the meal. Afterwards they kept apart a while in the drawing room for form's sake, but eventually gravitated together again, and finished the evening in each other's company. When, shortly after 11, he came away, he felt almost certain that within those luminous gray eyes the one of his eternal fidelity had verily taken lodgings and for a long lease. But this was not all. At parting, he had, almost involuntarily, given her hand a pressure of a peculiar and indescribable kind, a little response from her, like a mere pulsation, of the same sort, told him that the impression as he had made upon him was reciprocated. She was, in a word, willing to go on. But was he able? There had not been much harm in the flirtation thus far. But did she know his history, the curse upon his nature? That he was the wandering Jew of the love world, how restlessly ideal his fancies were, how the artist in him had consumed the wooer, how he was in constant dread lest he should wrong some woman twice as good as himself, by seeming to mean what he fain would mean but could not, how useless he was likely to be for practical steps towards householding, though he was all the while pining for domestic life. He was now over 40, she was probably 30, and he dared not make unmeaning love with the careless selfishness of a younger man. It was unfair to go further without telling her, even though, hitherto, such explicitness had not been absolutely demanded. He determined to call immediately on the new incarnation. She lived not far from the long, fashionable Hamptonshire Square, and he went thither with expectations of having a highly emotional time, at least. But somehow the very bell pull seemed cold, although as he had so earnestly asked him to come. As the house spoke, so spoke the occupant, much to the astonishment of the sculptor. The doors he passed through seemed as if they had not been opened for a month. And entering the large drawing room, he beheld, in an armchair, in the far distance, a lady whom he journeyed across the carpet to reach, and ultimately did reach. To be sure it was Mrs. Nicola Pinavon, but frosted over indescribably. Raising her eyes in a slightly inquiring manner from the book she was reading, she leant back in the chair, as if soaking herself in luxurious sensations which had nothing to do with him, and replied to his greeting with a few commonplace words. The unfortunate Jocelyn, though recuperative to a degree, was at first terribly upset by this reception. He had distinctly begun to love Nicola, and he felt sick and almost resentful. But happily his affection was incipient as yet, and a sudden sense of the ridiculous in his own position carried him to the verge of risibility during the scene. She signified a chair, and began the critical study of some rings she wore. They talked over the day's news, and then an organ began to grind outside. The tune was a rollicking air he had heard at some music hall, and, by way of a diversion, he asked her if she knew the composition. "No, I don't." She replied. "Now, I'll tell you all about it," said he gravely. "It is based on the sound old melody called the Jilt's Hornpipe. Just as they turn Madeira into port in the space of a single night, so this old air has been taken and doctored, and twisted about, and brought out as a new popular ditty. If you are in the habit of going much to the music halls, or the burlesque theaters, you would find this is often done, with excellent effect. Apostrophe, apostrophe, she thought a little, and then they went on to talk about her house, which had been newly painted, and decorated with greenish-blue satin up to the height of a person's head, an arrangement that somewhat improved her slightly faded, though still pretty, face, and was helped by the awnings over the windows. Yes, I have had my house some years, apostrophe, she observed complacently, and I like it better every year. Apostrophe, apostrophe, don't you feel lonely in it sometimes? Apostrophe, apostrophe, oh never. Apostrophe, apostrophe, however, before he rose she grew friendly to some degree, and when he left, just after the arrival of three opportune young ladies she seemed regretful. She asked him to come again, and he thought he would tell the truth. No. I shall not care to come again, apostrophe, he answered, in a tone inaudible to the young ladies. She followed him to the door. What an uncivil thing to say, apostrophe, she murmured in surprise. It is rather uncivil. Goodbye, apostrophe, said Pearson. As a punishment, she did not ring the bell, but left him to find his way out as he could. Now what the devil this means I cannot tell, apostrophe, he said to himself, reflecting stock still for a moment on the stairs. And yet the meaning was staring him in the face. Meanwhile one of the three young ladies had said, what interesting man was that, with his lovely head of hair? I saw him at Lady Chanelcliffe's the other night. Apostrophe, apostrophe, Jocelyn Pearson. Apostrophe, apostrophe, oh, Nicola, that is too bad. To let him go in that shabby way, when I would have given anything to know him. I have wanted to know him ever, since I found out how much his experiences had dictated his statuary, and I discovered them, by seeing in a Jersey paper of the marriage of a person supposed to be his wife, who ran off with him many years ago, don't you know, and then wouldn't marry him, in obedience to some novel social principles as he had invented for herself. Apostrophe, apostrophe, oh. Didn't he marry her? Apostrophe, said Mrs. Pinavon, with a start. Why, I heard only yesterday that he did, though they have lived apart ever since. Apostrophe, apostrophe, quite a mistake, apostrophe, said the young lady. How I wish I could run after him. Apostrophe, apostrophe, but Jocelyn was receding from the pretty widow's house with long strides. He went out very little during the next few days, but about a week later he kept an engagement to dine with Lady Iris Speedwell, whom he never neglected, because she was the brightest hostess in London. By some accident he arrived rather early. Lady Iris had left the drawing room for a moment, to see that all was right in the dining room, and when he was shown in there stood alone in the lamplight Nicola Pinavon. As he had been the first arrival, he had not in the least expected to meet her there, further than that, in a general sense, at Lady Iris's you expected to meet everybody. As he had just come out of the cloakroom, and was so tender, and even apologetic, that he had not the heart to be other than friendly. As the other guests dropped in, the pair retreated into a shady corner, and she talked beside him till all moved off for the eating and drinking. He had not been appointed to take her across to the dining room, but at the table found her exactly opposite. She looked very charming between the candles, and then suddenly it dawned upon him that her previous manner must have originated in some false report about Marcia, of whose existence he had not heard for years. Anyhow, he was not disposed to resent an inexplicability in womankind, having found that it usually arose independently of fact, reason, probability, or his own deserts. So he dined on, catching her eyes and the few pretty words she made opportunity to project across the table to him now and then. He was courteously responsive only, but Mrs. Pinavon herself distinctly made advances. He re-admired her, while at the same time her conduct in her own house had been enough to check his confidence enough, even to make him doubt if the well-beloved really resided within those contours, or had ever been more than the most transitory passenger through that interesting and accomplished soul. He was pondering this question, yet growing decidedly moved by the playful pathos of her attitude when, by chance, searching his pocket for his handkerchief, something crackled, and he felt there an unopened letter, which had arrived at the moment he was leaving his house, and he had slipped into his coat, to read in the cab as he drove along. Pearson drew it sufficiently forth, to observe by the postmark, that it came from his natal isle. Having hardly a correspondent in that part of the world now, he began to conjecture on the possible sender. The lady on his right, whom he had brought in, was a leading actress of the town indeed, of the United Kingdom and America, for that matter a creature in airy clothing, translucent, like a balsam or sea anemone, without shadows, and in movement as responsive as some highly lubricated, many-wired machine, which, if one presses a particular spring, flies open and reveals its works. The spring in the present case was the artistic commendation she deserved and craved. At this particular moment she was engaged with the man on her own right, a representative of family, who talked positively and hollowly, as if shouting down a vista of 500 years from the feudal past. The lady on Jocelyn's left, wife of a Lord Justice of Appeal, was in like manner talking to her companion on the outer side. So that, for the time, he was left to himself. He took advantage of the opportunity, drew out his letter, and read it as it lay upon his napkin, nobody observing him, so far as he was aware. It came from the wife of one of his father's former workmen, and was concerning her son, whom she begged Jocelyn to recommend as candidate for some post in town that she wished him to fill. But the end of the letter was what arrested him. "You will be sorry to hear, sir, that dear little Avice Carrow, as we used to call her in her maiden days, is dead. She married her cousin, if you do mind, and went away from here for a good few years, but was left a widow, and came back a 12-month ago, since when she faltered and faltered, and now she is gone. ..." 2, 3. She becomes an inaccessible ghost by imperceptible and slow degrees. The scene at the dinner table receded into the background, behind the vivid presentment of a Vice Carol, and the old scenes on Isle Vandilia which were inseparable from her personality. The dining room was real no more, dissolving under the bold stony promontory and the incoming West Sea. The handsome Marchioness in geranium red and diamonds, who was visible to him on his host's right hand opposite, became one of the glowing vermilion sunsets that he had watched so many times over Deadman's Bay, with the form of a vice in the foreground. Between his eyes and the judge who sat next to Nicola, with a chin so raw that he must have shaved every quarter of an hour during the day, intruded the face of a vice, as he had glanced at him in their last parting. The crannied features of the Evergreen Society lady, who, if as he had been a few years older, would have been as old-fashioned as her daughter, shaped themselves to the moldy quarries of his and Device's parents, down which he had clambered with Device hundreds of times. The ivy trailing about the tablecloth, the lights in the tall candlesticks, and the bunches of flowers, were transmuted into the ivies of the cliff-built castle, the tufts of seaweed, and the lighthouses on the isle. The salt airs of the ocean killed the smell of the viands, and instead of the clatter of voices came the monologue of the tide off the beel. More than all, Nicola Pine Avon lost the blooming radiance which she had latterly acquired. She became a woman of his acquaintance with no distinctive traits. She seemed to grow material, a superficies of flesh and bone merely, a person of lines and surfaces. She was a language in living cipher no more. When the ladies had withdrawn it was just the same. The soul of a vice, the only woman he had never loved of those who had loved him, surrounded him like a firmament. Art drew near to him in the person of one of the most distinguished of portrait painters. But there was only one painter for Jocelyn, his own memory. All that was eminent in European surgery addressed him in the person of that harmless and unassuming fogey whose hands had been inside the bodies of hundreds of living men. but the lily-white corpse of an obscure country girl chilled the interest of discourse with such a king of operators. Reaching the drawing room, he talked to his hostess. Though as he had entertained 23 guests at her table that night, as he had known, not only what every one of them was saying and doing throughout the repast, but what everyone was thinking. So, being an old friend, she said quietly, "What has been troubling you?" "Something has, I know. I have been traveling over your face, and have seen it there." Nothing could less express the meaning his recent news had for him than a statement of its facts. He told of the opening of the letter, and the discovery of the death of an old acquaintance. "The only woman whom I never rightly valued, I may almost say." He added, "and therefore the only one I shall ever regret." Whether she considered it a sufficient explanation or not, the woman of experiences accepted it as such. She was the single lady of his circle whom nothing erratic in his doings could surprise, and he often gave her stray ends of his confidence thus with perfect safety. He did not go near Mrs. Pinavon again. He could not. And on leaving the house, walked abstractedly along the streets till he found himself at his own door. In his room he sat down, and placing his hands behind his head, thought his thoughts anew. At one side of the room stood an escritoire, and from a lower drawer there he took out a small box tightly nailed down. He forced the cover with the poker. The box contained a variety of odds and ends, which Pearson had thrown into it from time to time in past years for future sorting, an intention that he had never carried out. From the melancholy mass of papers, faded photographs, seals, diaries, withered flowers, and such like, Jocelyn drew a little portrait, one taken on glass in the primitive days of photography, and framed with tinsel in the commonest way. It was a vice caro, as he had appeared during the summer month or two which he had spent with her on the island 20 years before this time, her young lips pursed up, her hands meekly folded. The effect of the glass was to lend to the picture much of the softness characteristic of the original. He remembered when it was taken during one afternoon they had spent together at a neighboring watering place, when he had suggested her sitting to a touting artist on the sands, there being nothing else for them to do. A long contemplation of the likeness completed in his emotions what the letter had begun. He loved the woman dead and inaccessible as he had never loved her in life. He had thought of her, but at distant intervals during the 20 years since that parting occurred, and only as somebody he could have wedded. Yet now the times of youthful friendship with her, in which he had learned every note of her innocent nature, flamed up into a yearning and passionate attachment, embittered by regret beyond words. That kiss which had offended his dignity, which as he had so childishly given him before her consciousness of womanhood had been awakened, what he would have offered to have a quarter of it now. Pearson was almost angry with himself for his feelings of this night, so unreasonably, motivelessly strong were they towards the lost young. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.